You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Welcome, everybody, and welcome to Oliver. Oliver is a longtime Berkman Center fellow here and has worked on a variety of projects, including the Law Lab and lots of other great things. He's also a professor of law at the Vermont Law School, and he's also an adjunct professor at the Engineering School at Dartmouth College, in addition to being a research fellow at the Grutter Institute. So welcome to Oliver. I know that he mentioned that he also has a few copies of the paper as well that he's going to be talking about. So if anybody would like a copy, we'll have them available here on the table.
Great.
Welcome, Oliver.
Thank you very much. And thank you all for joining me today and allowing me to explore with you some ideas that we're developing both here at Berkman and up at Vermont Law School on how to create a law school e-curriculum. As was mentioned, there are copies of the paper, which this reflects. The final version is in the Chicago Kent Law Review. There's a citation there, and I'll have a citation at the end, also available on SSRN. The outline of my presentation, first of all, a very brief disclaimer. I do some bits and pieces with the Treasury Department, the Office of Financial Research, which I'll mention. And when I'm mentioning that, these are not the views of the Treasury or the Office of Financial Research, but are my own. They request that we say things like that. I'm going to start with the view from law schools, then talk about the view from legal tech, talk about three principles to keep in mind in thinking about curriculum design and legal education reform. Value-added, values-added, and economic sustainability. Talk about where these might lead, opportunities and cautions, and in particular, talk about digital opportunities. Finally get to that e-lawyering, e-curriculum aspect for legal education, and talk a bit about some implementation ideas. Please do, by the way, feel free to jump in for questions. I'm hoping that I can get through the formal piece within 25 minutes or half an hour or so, which should leave us about half the time for discussion. I'm looking very much forward to hearing thoughts as well as to imparting them, so I'm hoping that we'll have a chance for some good discussion. View from law schools. The view from law schools. As a law professor, the word of the year is yikes, you know, or something along that line, you know, that we are all as law professors facing the fact that there's a great deal of challenge. The root cause of this challenge is at least in part the fact that legal practice is being challenged. The large firm model is shredding. We see Weil, Gotchel, and Menges just announced very significant layoffs. Other firms I'm aware of, I'm told that, for instance, Sherman and Sterling in New York, is, although they haven't engaged in layoffs, is now smaller than it was in 2003, that there has been a steady and somewhat conscious shrinkage going forward. And that's just the big law folks. There's effects up and down and across the profession. It's not just technology, but technology is a big piece of it. A significant restructuring going on in how law is practiced. And it's also not just up and down the profession, it's also across the profession. Courts are shifting into how they work. The e-court is emerging. It's, again, not the only, technology isn't the only factor in all of this, but cost pressures there, cost pressures in government, cost pressures, all the places that lawyers have done things are under pressure of innovation, of technology, of cost, a whole series of factors coming together to make this a challenging time in some ways to become a lawyer. By the way, those of you who are in law school, you're actually made the exact right decision, because what you want to do is to graduate in the slump. That's what you really want to do. But I'll cheer you up a little bit to say that that's not such a bad thing to do, particularly if you bring in the skills that are needed for the restructuring. Think about it for a moment. You are in a position to take some of those skills out into the world. Hopefully that will be a good reason to do it. However, that said, most people are not necessarily perceiving that this year. Legal education is in crisis, partly because of the employment of lawyers. There's all this bad press about, you know, you won't get a job. Again, slightly overstated, but again, if you get skills that will get you a job, you probably can. We'll talk about that. But it's not just about the employment. The relevancy of the training is under attack. There's a lot of question about, you know, practice-ready attorneys. Why are we training people to pretend that they want to be law professors when actually they want to be lawyers? and what does that mean, and what will law professors do about that. One of the things is that we add more experiential. The problem is, at least under the traditional model of adding experiential, that's the most expensive way to teach you. And if we're teaching you expensively in times when enrollments are under pressure and everything else is a problem, yikes, again, we've got that challenge going forward. There are potentially devastating declines in applications and enrollment. Everybody is experiencing this. It affects up and down the rankings. Up and down the rankings. This is something that I heard of a top 25 law school in which the dean earlier this year spoke to the faculty and said, the days of fat, dumb, and happy are over. And this was a top 25 law school. I spoke with someone from a top 10 law school just recently who said they're feeling it. I will not impute anything to the law school on whose periphery we sit here, but my expectation is that it is not. Things are filtering through. They may be buffered, but they're filtering through. So anyway, the effects are up and down the rankings in law school. Legal education is, I think, fair to say, is in a state of crisis at the moment. Let me contrast that view with a view from the Legal Tech show. What is Legal Tech? Legal Tech is a show for legal technology. Legal Tech is a commercially operated show. It has a New York and a Los Angeles version. There's also, by the way, the ABA show on law and technology out in Chicago. These three are the sort of the major jamborees of law and technology in the U.S. I was there in January 2013 along with some Vermont law school colleagues, including my colleague Gene Yikes, who is here. We were attending with a group of law students. We'll get to that in a moment. It is an astonishing place to go and have a look and see where law is headed, where law already is. There's $20 to $30 billion in law-related commerce represented at that show, by my estimate. That's a lot of activity. And while e-discovery is the big one, e-discovery is the one where with the greatest impact. There are lots and lots of other categories as well. Everything from document assembly, process and practice management, all kinds of things going on there. And my take-home insight this year, I've been a couple of times before, and a couple of times I said, "Oh my goodness, look at all this activity supporting law." And my insight this time, helped in part by Bill Henderson from Indiana, was, oh no, this is law. This is the practice of law. The practice of law had sorted itself into these things we called firms and legal departments and stuff like that. It's resorting. And indeed, what we're seeing on the floor there is how law is currently practiced, how it will be practiced. This is a piece of how law works. And indeed, my corollary to this is that firms are no longer the best way to do this. Firms were a temporal solution to problems of scale, workflow smoothing, promotion and recruiting, a whole set of different pieces that the firm came together and provided a reasonable solution for. Guess what? They're not the best solution anymore, at least for a lot of these things. And it may well be that an outsourcing company in India combined with an onshore technology company combined with some remnant of a firm that may be a couple of partners who know people at various companies, that may be the better solution for what happens in law as opposed to the firm. So the firm, the demise of the firm, I think at least in its current form, is something we will increasingly see as these other solutions, these other types of solutions, basically beat them at the game they were good at going forward. So anyway, there we go. This is law practice. And these are law jobs. And indeed, we were exploring that because along with us from VLS came about eight or nine of our students. We arranged for them to get cheap floor passes. They went around and A, we're seeing what it looked like, and B, handing out resumes. And indeed, right there on the floor of the trade show, two or three people got interviews. I'm aware of at least one, I think two actually, who have gotten jobs out of that. You know, out of eight people, that's not so bad. Out of one outing, you know, think about it. You know, you folks who are law students, you know, whoa, okay, you know, that's not so bad, okay. And if you multiply that by additional possibilities, anyway, you see what I'm saying. This is where at least a big chunk of law practice is headed. The astonishing thing, other astonishing thing was almost nobody else was there from legal academia. Almost nobody else was there. Bill Henderson was there. Dan Katz was there. A couple other my colleagues from Vermont Law School. A couple other folks, the Cali folks were there. But very, very few people from Legal Academia was there. It was like this entire thing was happening, and it was completely off the radar for almost all of Legal Academia. I think perhaps not so much in the future, but there we are. So what is this, and how are we going to teach it? Well, that takes me back, since I'm a law professor, this takes me first to theory, right? I got to talk about theory before I get to practicality. We're going to talk a little bit about what are the requirements of legal education. Because as we think about this great crisis, the crisis is also an opportunity for restructuring. We're going to restructure legal education. And as we restructure it, I think we need to keep some things in mind. And this is my list of what we need to keep in mind. I think it needs to have value added. Why in the world would someone come to a legal education unless there's value added? Now, value is not just economic. I mean, there is an economic element to it. You want to get a good career. You want to actually be able to pay those loans off. You want that to actually make economic sense. But there's also other aspects of value added. There's social value that's added. You know, the law is still a fundamentally important profession for the United States of America and for the world. So we need to bring folks along, and you can have a piece of that. There's a social value to it. There's personal value. The law is a decent profession. And a senior lawyer, when I was thinking about law school, said years ago, told me, yeah, think about law school. It's clean indoor work. Okay, and there's some truth to that. It's clean indoor work. That's not so bad in this world. There's reasons to go value added, but what that value added looks like, I'm going to argue, as you would expect, changes and is changing now, and we need to make sure we do that. There's values added. Law is a normative exercise. Education should reflect this, right? I'll get that in a moment. Effectiveness as a value is something we should think about. And it needs to be economically sustainable. The activity of legal education has to be economically sustainable. We need to have the price match the return. We need to have the price also match the salary structure. There's a whole set of things that have to go forward if this is actually going to work that are a little bit out of whack. The old model is maxing out, quite frankly. The old model of asking law students to really fund, for most institutions, the vast majority of the cost is just maxing out, particularly at the level of salary, intensiveness of instruction, additional increased facilities, all those things. You put the input and the outflow together, and they just don't match very well anymore, unless you've got a huge endowment, and even then. All right. So let me go start here a little bit more with values added. It's a legal specialty. The content may vary. You know, what are the values of legal education? Different law schools argue back and forth. But the idea, I think, is central to almost any law school going forward, that one of the things we really want to do is to see people have values brought to it. Up at Vermont Law School, we have social and environmental justice as a particular value that we bring. There are some places to talk about the citizen lawyer, creating people who will have that sort of civic duty to support the legal system. We look for some intellectual breadth and sophistication. We look for perspectives, international and beyond the trade stuff. By the way, I'm going to take a brief aside on this trade school thing, because, you know, people throw out, well, we don't want to be a trade school. And I say, well, why not? You know, most of our graduates want to practice law. And the notion that we should be ashamed of training them to do the thing they actually want to do is just astounding to me. So anyway, I sit here, and, you know, trade school is not sometimes it's thrown out as an insult in the legal academy. To me, it's a badge of honor. Not just a trade school, but one of the multiple things we should be doing is accomplishing the trade. And so we want intellectual breadth and sophistication beyond the trade. That's a value. And high effectiveness. High effectiveness is a value. It's harder for academics to envision. We can be dismissive of instrumental competence, but I think that effective actual delivery of legal services is in itself a value that is important to us as lawyers, and we should inculcate. Also, effectiveness is evolving. Broad advocacy, project management, digital capacity are part of what effectiveness looks like going forward. Economically sustainable. Curriculum needs to be cost effective. As I said, cost per credit hour on average is a limit. The institution needs to be sustainable, which includes not only teaching, research, activism, and it must as a package support itself. And the future is changing. The old tuition model, as I mentioned, is maxing out. Other models are coming in, projects, institutes, distance learning. Are we going to look more like other departments? In other departments in the university, research is supported through grants, and teaching is done by teaching fellows and big lectures in a variety of different ways. At least has been done. It will probably change. So the refrain from the deans again: the happy days are over. Well, then let me focus in a little bit now on back to value added, because I think this is where I want to spend a chunk of time. Value, traditional expectations. What a lawyer needed to know then, i.e. a year or two ago. Then, first of all, I think it was fair to say that we wanted to educate people for bar passage substance. If you graduate from a law school and are at least not assisted in passing the bar, then you know, it strikes me that that was a failure in its mission. Now, up and down the pecking order, there may be a greater or lesser notion of this, but again, without throwing too many aspersions at our friends down at Yale, they're the only law school in America I think of which really would just assume you didn't pass the bar. You know, that you went on and got a philosophy degree instead and didn't bother with this nastiness of actual practicing. But anyway, them apart, I can't really imagine that the passage of the bar is not at least a goal and a significant goal of just about anybody's legal education. Second on the list is getting based in an argument on what law is. What is law? And there's a kind of a standard shared basis of argumentation that Anglo-American and in particular American law students and lawyers are expected to be proficient at. Whether it's statutory case, the Langdellian method, the realist and critical, you know, this swath of argumentation, which is the first year curriculum. The first year curriculum at most law schools in the United States of America is much more about getting you embedded in this argumentation than it is actually any particular subject matter you're going to take. Contracts teaches you nothing we need to know about contracts, but does teach you to argue about the law. Okay? So we have that as a second level. Third, I would say, in the classic mix is skills, which includes writing, research, problem solving, client-related stuff. You know, this is the McCrate Report, the Carnegie Report, all of these reports that have come in and said, we need people more actually engaged with what lawyers, in fact, will do over their lives, as opposed to just an academic version of this argumentation. We need that to have that embedded. That has progressed, so I think in most law schools in the United States, and indeed to some degree internationally, that is seen as a necessary piece of the process. And then some perspectives, as I've mentioned before, we want you to have some policy, some interdisciplinary, some international, you know, this is the citizen lawyer piece, this is figuring out, it's, you know, how to be not just the instrumental piece, but also having some perspective. And again, that's a worthy goal. I think all these are good, worthy goals and worth improving, but I'm arguing they're simply not enough anymore. They're just not enough. You know, you graduate like that, guess what? You're not educated for what you need to be today. So emerging expectations now. All of the above and more. And defining more is at least part of our task for our discussions today. Cautions, three cautions. Caution number one, the Yerka question trap. What is that? My colleague at Vermont Law School, Carl Yerka, is the librarian there, and he has a modest notoriety among law librarians for the Yerka question. And the Yerka question is essentially, what really good thing are we doing today that we're proud of that we'll have to stop in order to do the new thing that we have to add and do tomorrow? Law schools, because partly of soaking the incoming students for a lot of tuition increases, have been in the position of not having to actually do that so much. They have just added. It's been great. You know, we just add, hey, we got another good idea, we'll just add. The problem is, going back to the economic sustainability, that in the end you bump up against some wall, and I think we have done that. So we're going to have to ask ourselves, what is it that we really like doing we're going to stop today? Let me take a cheap shot example at legal research. Legal research taught by folks who are really good at it, often folks who just love things like shepherdizing. And they will take you through the books, right, of shepherdizing, and then nobody ever looks at those anymore. Why? Because you've got machines that do it for you almost automatically in there. They say, well, someday, you know, power may go out and you'll need to shepherd. And the answer to that is just no. Stop, you know, just get rid of it. It takes a class. We don't have that many classes. It's essentially a useless exercise. It was lovely in its day. It was fabulous. It's done. It's cooked. Get rid of it. We're going to have to make a bunch of those choices about that. We have too many targets, not enough choices, not enough time. We need to multitask to some degree to layer in different lessons into different things. And we also just have to make hard choices about what we're not going to bother with. Get rid of talking about consideration in the first year. Just get rid of it. Get rid of talking about personal jurisdiction in the first year for months. Get rid of it. It's irrelevant to most practice. You can learn what you need to learn in 2 hours, and it's just a way to talk about argumentation. not useless in that context. It's beautiful. People are good at it. People have spent their lives getting good at it. It's beautiful. It's irrelevant. Get rid of it. Okay? I run fast. I run fast. There we go. Caution number two, the academic specialty trap. This is to some degree related to what you've just heard. What we need to teach is distinct from what we like to study. Law professors love jurisdiction questions. They're complex. They allow us to show off that we're one of the best at that modes of argumentation we've been telling you about. They're fabulous. We shouldn't feel that what we're fabulous at is what we need to teach. We need to listen intelligently, not stupidly, but intelligently to the marketplace. We need to figure out what we do, what people coming in, our students really need to know, and we need to teach that. We should not just confuse research value with lawyer value. So I'll say in a little bit, I'm one of the pioneers of law and neuroscience. Yes?
I come from a kind of like the Yale of Canada, which is McGill.
And right.
They're training us to be philosophers in a sense. But I also value that. I agree with you. I think that there should be more of a focus on practice, like practical skills. But how would you balance that in a curriculum?
What a gorgeous question. And indeed, one of the things is you keep a piece of that in your curriculum. But I at least and one of the possible models, quite frankly, is to say if you want that, then we'll have a specialty third year for you to have it in. Okay? Or if we want that, McGill and Yale should exist. All right? They don't have to be other places. And indeed, I think that there's actually the true blending of intellectuality in the law is when you bring all of that background knowledge and all of the foreground knowledge of skill and blend them. That's why we're not a PhD program in philosophy, because you've got to square both. So it is a conundrum. There we are. I'm overstating a little bit, and I apologize. But there we are. This is a polemic, and not. You know, so we can have fun. So, but the core piece is do not confuse research value with lawyer value. As I was saying, I'm one of the founders of the subfield of law and neuroscience. I love it. It's fabulous stuff. Should I be offering three courses in law and neuroscience? No. Should I offer any course in law and neuroscience? Maybe not. I have. It's fun. You know, students are part of that perspective process. But I should not. Now, does it inform how I teach? Yes. Scholarship is fabulous, informs teachers should do it, all that good stuff. But we should not confuse the thing that we're telling our students they should spend a precious amount of a very limited resource of time learning with our research interests. Among the law students here, you know, you've taken those courses from the con law professor, right? Who got way down some rat hole of a constitutional law that they love, and it's gorgeous. Why did we spend four precious weeks doing that? Well, because it taught you argumentation at a deep level, and that's one answer. But I'm not sure it's enough. Caution number three, which is related to the current expertise trap. We hate, particularly as law professors, to learn new things. We really, you know, we learned some tricks early on. We got good at it. We've been following that line. The new stuff requires us to learn new things and to get on the wrong side of expertise barriers. Law professors love to be in a position of power over the subject matter. So law professors, including people who are associated here, love the law of technology, because then they get to be the law of technology. What's interesting is when you become student of the technology of law, because now you're in that secondary position in the argument, and it's a much dicier and more vulnerable spot to be in. So again, the current expertise trap has a number of those things. So digital lawyering, why is this important? Why is this important? Now we're getting into it. Why should we take some of those precious moments away from personal jurisdiction and devote them to technology? Why should the technology of law be one of those things that we actually embed into all of this as we go forward? Well, as I hope to suggest, it is a new frontier in law and lawyer activity, and I've got a little bit of a laundry list here. Bear with me while I go through it. First of all, courts and dispute resolution, evidence, e-discovery. Courts are becoming e-courts. One of the justices of the Vermont Supreme Court, Jeannie Ikes and I teach a class on e-lawyering at Vermont Law School. We've been lucky enough on several occasions to have Justice Dooley from the Vermont Supreme Court come in. And he basically had the insight that the traditional pleadings are an ordered data field in written text. that they are a data field. They're an organized data field. Why do we have the headings and all those things and all that funny way that we learn how to order it? It's because we need order into our data fields in litigation. What he basically said is, why do I need all of that when I've got tagging? You know, tagging is the ability to assign metadata labels to stuff. Guess what? It's just metadata. The order of the pleading is just metadata. We can skip straight to it when we've got, why have all those things? So courts are moving in this direction. Not fully there yet. They still think that a PDF Dropbox is a major technological improvement. There's room to go. There's room to grow. But it is happening. And we need to have lawyers trained into that. Not only into it, what it is now, but into what it can be. Evidence, e-discoveries. You saw e-discoveries, $20 billion a year. I was at a AALS conference some years ago when I went to the securities law panel, and they had three professors and a practitioner, and each was supposed to say what was the biggest development in the last year, and the professors talked about Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank and, you know, the SEC, etc. And the practitioner, when it became his turn, said e-discovery. He said, essentially, all of our litigation is e-discovery-based now, and it has just blown how we do this all to pieces. So it's there. The law of digital activity. Well, this is the law of now, so this is the one that the professors particularly care for in the current activity. Law of digital activity, privacy, IP, information policy, etc. Again, one. I'm not poo-pooing it at all. It's important stuff. But 2% of the lawyers in the United States of America will get to practice this. 98% will deal with the technology of law in ways that they have to be inventive with. Research and writing, again, LexisNexis, Westlaw, Bloomberg, all those tools, you know, Google, you know, all the stuff that's coming in on that, something that folks need to learn about. And indeed, the whole notion of research and writing is changing. I'm aware that at least one of the major companies now, if you use their software to do research, will use those kinds of algorithms you get in Netflix and say, people who cited this often like to cite that. And they'll critique the logic in your brief if you really let them. So you know, I mean, it is not as they say your grandmother's legal research anymore. There's very interesting stuff going on there. Government service delivery. Almost all interactions with the government are now e-mediated in some fashion or another. Right? You know, you want to do something with the tax IRS, you go to their website. You want to do something with the secretary. It's all done through websites. All done through this. We've got some conversations going, for instance, with the Vermont Department of Environmental Protection, who are desperate for getting better at this. Why? Because they're under cost pressures, they're under pressures for better processes, not just cheaper processes, better processes. How do you have a hearing? What does the Administrative Procedure Act look like in an E world? Nobody's rewritten that yet. It needs to be rewritten. It will be rewritten. It'll look like something very different. How do you crowdsource a reg? There are experiments going on all this. It's happening, and we need to educate people in it. Advocacy. Advocacy is not just about being in court anymore. This is Bill McKibben, the well-known environmentalist, has made this point that essentially you win in the court of public opinion first, and then the politics and that Supreme Court follow you. I think that the recent developments in marriage equity and some other things reflect the fact that public attitudes change, and guess what? The Supreme Court goes, oh, you know, the evolving standards of justice mean, and it's not just the progressives on the court who do that, notwithstanding their announced opposition to it, the conservatives do it as well. The developments in things like corporate personhood and all of that follow after a whole prolonged set of conversations about economics that have progressed through society as well. So you need to be educated in what advocacy looks like in this world of technology. Berkman, let me give a brief plug, number of Berkman programs around exactly that stuff, around, you know, both crowdsourced and individual. I mean, there's some great stuff going on here, as in other places around some of that. Analysis. EPA databases paired with epidemiology. Or there was a great app that came out of Georgetown last year on the law of same-sex marriage in around the United States. I mean, these apps of analysis that you can do. Client interaction, professional presentation. Increasingly, people are starting up virtual law practices, places where you just go. I mean, I buy lots of my stuff through the web. People buy their legal services through the web. If you want to see a nightmare version of this, Google Divorce Deli. It's fabulous in its own way. But they're right out of the edge of all of this. But there are much more kind of conservative versions. Major law firms basically do this. A couple of the British law firms that do banking law have free bank documents that people can go to and get off their website. Wilson Sonsini has its term sheet generator for deals in tech. You know, people are giving away stuff on the web as loss leaders, and even the big firms are doing this. Access to justice, legal service, and advice. Now, there are some big arguments about that. I'll get down to that a little further in a moment, about the fact that really this is democratizing law, for better and worse, but it's democratizing law. The ability to go and get cheap stuff at places like Divorce Deli is democratization, and goodness knows the law could use some of that. Platform and program design and implementation. There's all of these things involve software. And guess what? The engineers have been writing this software, and they don't always do it terribly well because they don't understand law. We should go the other way and say, lawyers, you know, get tech enough so that you can go talk to these people. I was lucky enough to be involved in a project here where we had a collaborative software development project around automating a limited liability company operating agreements. It was a great partnership here between me and the tech people. I learned a lot. Hopefully they learned a lot. The end product's pretty good. Been adopted by Nevada. It's not a bad thing to do to get that way. Importance continued. Oh, whew. Digital jurisprudence. It's intellectually essential. The Langdellian changes that came in the late 19th century out of, you know, buildings down that way were basically technologically grounded. Huh? Cheaper printing meets German textual criticism, and we have 120 years of jurisprudence in the United States of America. Okay? By the way, the West system is founded in the same decade as Langdell's revolution. Why? Because text is getting cheap. Cheap text makes textually based arguments of the classic kind possible. There's a technological possibility that makes that happen, not the other way around. We're blowing that open with all the possibilities now. The early versions of tech put that on steroids, right? In LexisNexis, you can find a case that agrees with anything. Essentially, therefore, it's irrelevant. And now we're in the early stages of what is the next Langdellian revolution in terms of jurisprudence and figuring out how we make a compelling argumentation in a world of tech. Wow, wouldn't it be great to be early stages in that? If you want to have a jurisprudential, if you want to go to Yale or McGill and get one of those things, you know, do that as what you do, not bad Hegelian philosophy. Okay? There we go. Well, what does Hegel have to say about this when you're in a world of tech where that's, you know, is it instrumental to use this? Is it not? I mean, you know, there's a whole bunch of questions we can do. Sorry to pick on you. There we go. What is law is changing? Law is getting Turinged. It's getting restructured. Let's say code is code. Code is law. You know, that's a fabulous insight from it. You know, 15 years ago, right? 20 years ago? It is and still a fabulous underexploited insight on where it can all go. And then there's the big project, as I call it, true computational law. Dan Katz out at Michigan State is working on this. There are other leaders, you know, truly making the law computational. Machine computational rather than head computational. There's an algebra. Algebra lets you do word problems in a formal way. Before algebra, you know, well, how long did it take a train to get there if it traveled, you know, in both directions and had six people jumping on and off? You know, how did you do those problems when they were word by a kind of brute force analysis? How do we do problems of contracting now? We do them by brute force word-based analysis. There are apps for that waiting to be discovered. And indeed, one of the projects we're working on at VLS is some of that. In my own current work, again, not to by any means other than just it's what I'm aware of, here at the Berkman Law Lab, we've done things on automation of legal processes. At Vermont Law School, we've got stuff going. We've got a Google grant there to look at what are the underlying bases of governance that can be plugged into a kind of an automated process. The work that with the Office of Financial Research I'm involved with is around automating financial contracts, automating those contracts that Wall Street has worked on. How would you do that, both at a sort of entry level of extraction of data and metadata, but also with this notion of can you make them computational in and of themselves? Working with the Grutter Institute of Law and Behavior Research, the Kauffman Foundation has been very generous both to here and in other places in supporting a lot of these projects, really trying to reinvent law, to take the phrase from the folks at Michigan State. So there's a bunch of stuff out there. Again, importance continued. Jobs, law tech, we've talked about. This is legal practice too, nearly untapped by law schools yet. We got about 3 or 4 years before, but you know, we can get a leadership position in that. Graduates become managers of technology, not the casualties of it. That's at least my goal. Access to justice. Let me come back to this one. This is key. You can bring the law to many. Ron Stout out at Chicago, Kent is a leader on this, has some wonderful writing around this. The ABA is behind some of this a bit, at any rate. One of the problems is the making the perfect the enemy of the good. That this is not as good as giving everybody a fully trained, high-priced lawyer at their disposal no matter what. And as we all know, if we've seen the rocky progress of legal aid and the number of people who go unserved or underserved, it's a lovely ideal. It is not happening. Moving into these places where you can use automation to do good, but not perfect help, I think is a good idea. Now, there are those who will argue with me back and say, no, you know, you're making compromises. We've already made compromises. They're worse compromises, I think, than they would be if we actually use tech to extend stuff. I'll let Ron Stout's writing stand for some of this. He's got a whole project going on this. I think it's very good. Creative destruction, just creative destruction. The mild anarchist in me is happy with the idea, you know, that things happen, you know. It's not all the same all the time. We can imagine new and make new happen. Levitt said, to survive, organizations will have to plot the obsolescence of what now produces their livelihood. Because if you don't plot the obsolescence internally, somebody outside will, and then guess what? You're toast. So you got to do it internally. My argument to law schools is that they just need to be doing this because this is what's up there. All right, so what does the teaching look like? I'm using more time than I should. I apologize. Teaching across the curriculum. As a must. I mean, just part of it is across the curriculum. E-courts, evidence, transactions, you know, these can go into classic classes on litigation, civil procedure, evidence, transactions classes. I won't say the word, nasty word, contracts classes again, because it's just not about transactions, but real transaction-based classes. Specialty courses. This is difficult because we're up against the Yerka question again. What don't we teach? Our Vermont Law School experience. We've got a list of these we're developing. Other places do too. Document assembly, expert systems. So the Suffolk folk I know are engaged in this as well. Data and e-discovery, practice project litigation management, virtual practice. This is at least a portion of what any of these programs need to be doing. We have, at Vermont Law School, our curriculum committee has approved most of these, and we're in the process of populating them as we go forward. So again, there are other folks who are doing good jobs with this too, but it's sitting there ready and waiting to happen. Their degree possibilities, masters of legal technology, is that something that we could put into distance teaching? Activities, apps clubs, game design, law wikis, there's a bunch of things that can be done. The law review is waiting to be restructured. You know, the law review sits out there, it's got a lot of prestige and a bunch of things. What it's doing is almost useless in most cases now. Sorry, my friends at the law reviews. That it's lovely. They published me, I'm so appreciative, it's great. But if they imagined into what is the next thing that law review should be, would that be a more productive thing? And indeed, all these subsidiary journals, I challenge some subsidiary journal just to beat Harvard Law Review at its own game and figure out what is the next thing and do it. And then be the next thing. Research placement. Each student should have a professional website. Again, that's something we're working on at VLS. Other places are doing the same. Everybody should have a professional website that just there's a place they can post things where prospective lawyers go. That's the easy one. Boy, that's low hanging fruit. Research and scholarship. Grant and contract driven, as we've said, probably rather than necessarily driven in the classic law professor in the library way. There's consulting for student and faculty in this. They're consulting dollars. You can get summer jobs. You can get jobs during the term. There's stuff sitting out there ready to go. And so much more. Other points for innovation and change. Again, suggestions back would be great. There's the new pedagogy, which is sort of the other side of tech in this space. How do we engage tech not as the subject matter, but as the delivery method? The edX folks, the Harvard's law MOOC that went out this time. We have one of its principal organizers here. She's blushing and hiding, you know. But folks who want to know about it should talk. It was an excellent experiment. Lots of good stuff coming out of that. On distance learning, there's also the Blue Paper, which a program in the legal profession here at Harvard has, which is a best practices in distance learning for legal education. I will take a little credit help do that. My colleague at Vermont, Rebecca Purdom, was the key author on that, the lead author. Gamification. gamification, if you don't like that, talk about extended interactive simulation. There's folks in the law profession who go, we couldn't possibly teach with gamification, but they could teach with extended interactive simulation. And it does that. Again, there's a bunch of that going on. I will shout out one more time my colleague here, Jeannie Ikes, who is consulting with LexisNexis on their gamification stuff. There's other folks doing pieces of that. It's out there and ready to arrive. New classroom approaches, flipped classroom. The ABA, I know, is a problem with this, but you know, there's a bunch of stuff that we can do with some very intelligent people working on how to do a whole bunch of that. New licenses and degrees. There's the medical models of these intervening new licenses. Do we have the same thing as physician assistants? Are there going to be attorney assistants? The answer is yes, they already are. I think it's Oregon, Washington did that. Vermont is considering it. A bunch of places are considering it as a means for this kind of intermediate stage of help. Would you have a JM degree? You know, a Juris Master's? You know, do we step back and do 18 months and get somebody ready to be a closing specialist for a real estate firm? The closing specialist in a real estate firm probably doesn't need to know anything about my old friend personal jurisdiction, right? It's just not a necessity, but could be very capable at closings in those kind of contexts. The Vermont Law School, we have the master's in legal, environmental law and policy, which is a version of that. Environmental professionals, government people, it's a master's, which is kind of a law degree light, but very useful for what they want and need. So conclusions. The crisis is real, but also an opportunity. As I said, there were three design elements that should be kept in mind: values added, and economic sustainability. As I went through that value added long thing, we should keep in the back of mind that legal education should also be about values added, and it better be economically sustainable or it won't work. Technology of law has an important piece of the puzzle. I hope I've made the case that we need an e-curriculum. We need to really embed this thoroughly, both as specialty courses and across the curriculum. It's an opportunity with many facets. And I thank you, and I give thanks to the Berkman Center, which has supported a lot of this, the Kauffman Foundation, which has, in fact, supported the Berkman Center while it was doing some of this, Vermont Law School, whose Center of Legal Innovation I'm in charge of, the Grutter Institute, which you've heard mentioned, LexisNexis, which has published the book Educating the Digital Lawyer, which is available for free on the Program for the Legal Profession website, Program for the Legal Profession here, which has hosted some of these developments as well. And I will leave you with further references to look at and write down if you wish, Educating the Digital Lawyer, the distance learning white paper, and then that's the SSRN link to the paper of mine from Chicago Kent, which this is drawn from. Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, we'll kind of work our way around the room.
Yeah. So this is great. I mean, as you know, I'm a big believer and supporter in the concept, certainly in a lot of the specifics of all of this. I think it's exactly where we have to go. But I want to go back to the question of balance and how we figure out the right both amount and specifics of the old stuff that we need to keep that really makes somebody a well-rounded, rich lawyer able to shift. And you know, if you think about it, most people 20, 30 years into their legal career are in a very different place than they ever imagined they would be when they were getting out of law school. So there's this notion that you know, you want people to be very flexible and have a very solid education, go a lot of different directions. So how do we figure out what parts to keep versus what are the parts we really should be experimenting with and changing? And that goes back to your notion of listening to the marketplace. Part of what's always troubled me is I just don't think we have a good sense of what the market and law firms and government agencies that hire lawyers really want. We hear about practice-ready lawyers, we hear about more experiential education, but I don't really know what that means, and I wonder about the process of translating that into changes in the way we teach.
What a good set of questions. One thing that I haven't said, which is you have to, you know, why did we have this old system? And one of the reasons we've had the old system is that kind of extended Langdalian program, if I can call it that, was a very good way to sort for a certain kind of raw cleverness. And one of the problems with teaching, as I do, I teach both styles, one of the problems with teaching a skills-based curriculum is that if you're good at it, most of your students get it. And once they get it, you have to give them a B plus or an A minus at the very least, because you can't, you know, I mean, they got it, right? You know, okay. So a skills-based teaching approach is less good at filtering for a certain kind of clever. And one of the things that the old system did with its kind of, you know, exam at the end and all that kind of thing was provide a flawed but nonetheless usable filter for certain kinds of things. Also, there was a certain prestige aspect associated with it, and so you got hot people who had been through that filter, hiring people who were also coming through that filter. There was a set of reinforcing reasons why people, although it didn't actually do what then they actually had to do, it provided a hazing filter, whatever you want to call it, kind of experience. I think that that is breaking down to a large but not complete degree. Because I think that A, we can have better filters, if we really want to have filters, that will in fact relate more to what people are needing to do rather than this kind of Mandarin system. You know, the old Mandarin system in China was set of if you wanted to go into the government in old China, you would take these exams, and the exams were all about Confucianism and had nothing really to do with running anything, but they were, you know, what you went through, and you moved on up taking those exams. In some way, the old law school curriculum was that kind of a program. That said, you know, you don't want to lose A, because people expect you to be able to have that conversation. B, you know, there's some value in it. There is value in perspectives, there's value in all these things. So I think you need to figure out, as you say, the balance. To me, one way to do it is to surface all of this and be explicit about it. So instead of having a first year in which you reduplicate the argumentation thing 6 times and then hope by the end people actually get it, you know, intentionally teach it twice. Maybe select 2 classes, you know, keep property and a contract torts combo, you know, and use those as a way to teach the old fashioned, you know, reasoning skills and the common law, and then get on with something else. You know, figure out what you want them to learn in terms of perspectives, if you're teaching, what the marketplace wants them to be able to have in terms of perspectives, what being good citizens requires to be in terms of perspectives. Teach that intentionally and get on with it. I think Harvard, with its Ledge Reg class, had a piece of that corner, or had a corner of that where they said, yeah, we want people to know this. Let's do it intentionally. Everybody said, oh, you'll pick it up. Well, you know, yeah, okay. If you really want people to know stuff, teach that explicitly, rather, and I would do that across the curriculum as a design element. So figure out what you want to keep, what you don't want to keep, and then make it more explicit rather than as spread around. Then use the time that you free up by being so explicit to pop in practice management skills, things on what it means to be a lawyer, mindfulness and the law. I mean, you know, there's a whole set of reflective things that most lawyers aren't taught about in law school. They should be. They're the big dissatisfaction 10 years down. Well, why is it all seeming so appalling? Well, let me have some tools to reflect on that rather than not. And then the tech. I mean, there's a number of things we can talk about dropping into the curriculum once we start to think this way. But I would urge you to figure out how to deliver what you want from the old stuff within 50% of what we're currently time it's taking, and then free up the other 50 to teach something else. Yes, and then here. Sorry. Yeah.
I had a question about, you know, the sort of role that perhaps the analytical role that law schools might be able to play, or at least legal research. I spent a few years as an associate at a law firm doing a bunch of e-discovery stuff. And, you know, one of the worst experiences was doing privilege review. And as time was, and it was all on e-discovery, yeah, and it was like click a button for, you know, 7-8 hours a day. And as time was running down, the partners were like, well, we're just going to, you know, do a search for a bunch of keywords. And the keywords seemed to be more or less randomly picked out of a hat, you know, relating to like law, lawyer, you know, confidential, you know, stuff. And there didn't really seem to be any intellectual rigor behind the methodology that they were doing. And so I was wondering whether there's been any work either on the technology side or in the legal side in sort of looking at, you know, best practices, you know, like if you do randoms, if, you know, if you search for lawyer in, you know, a bunch of you know, legal documents produced at a Fortune 500 company or a bunch of documents, you know, what are the, you know, how, you know, what's the false positive rate? What's the false negative rate? You know, and to bring some rigor that then could be useful to practitioners to say, you know, okay, you know, if we use the following, you know, 20 keywords, we'll, you know, be over-inclusive by 10%, and that's an acceptable risk to us.
And the answer is that stuff's happening.
In the industry, there's this whole thing of predictive coding you may have heard of, which is exactly the kind of thing you're talking about. They've shifted over to learning algorithms. At a conference about a year ago, there was a partner of, I think it was Skadden Arps, who was there. They've got their own proprietary version of this because exactly some of the things you're talking about. The whole predictive coding piece of the e-discovery industry is trying very much to do this. The data suggests that I've seen that the predictive coding is now better than humans over time. Why? Because A, they learn from humans, you know, learning algorithms with, you know, trying to reproduce, and humans get tired. The algorithm's not as good as a fresh human. By the end of your 8-hour day, you didn't care, right? You know, you didn't know. And there we are. By the way, I did a version of this when I was a young associate back in the day, which was to go through the bonds in the New York City bond litigation with a highlighter, and every time I saw the right words, king, you know, and for day after day I did this, and I complained to the partner who said, I don't know if this is true or not, but he said, Holmes once said, you know, if you want to be a lawyer, you have to learn to eat sawdust. And one of the nice things about machines is they eat sawdust better, you know, once you teach them well than humans do. So exactly the kind of stuff you're talking about is going forward. Not so much in the academy, because the academy really isn't there, but there's legal opinions out there about, you know, what the standards are. There's companies working on it. There are law firms working on it. It's exactly what you're talking about is going forward. Yes, and then we'll come back here.
So, like, law, medicine, and business are traditionally the three professional schools in universities, and I was wondering if you looked at law, business, and medicine and see, like, what lessons law schools could take from them, or, like, what mistakes they made that law schools could avoid.
That's a good question. Good question. I haven't as much as I should. That's an excellent suggestion. I'm vaguely aware of medicine's restructuring, although I think that they still have not been fully Turinged. There's a lovely short article out there saying, "Have you been Turinged?" As in Turing, the inventor of the computer, and basically saying that has your field of endeavor been completely restructured by the ability to move at least a number of the processes into some kind of computing? Medicine is to some degree there. Diagnostics are not not there yet. So at least the technology piece isn't fully there, but the multi-layering of the profession has certainly hit medicine, and the pricing of the top end out of the marketplace and trying to figure out how to restructure back. We're only in the beginning stages of it because we have actually socialized the cost of that, which I think is probably a good thing to do. You know, I'm a moderate fan of the national health kind of approaches, less perhaps of the actual one we got than the ones we might have gotten. But but there are reasons to socialize that cost. But as we put it into social, you know, into society as a whole, we're going to see immense increasing pressures to make it cheaper. It's just going to have to be. And as we see those pressures again, we'll see that restructuring. We haven't done that with legal representation. It's still largely private cost. Will we see other models? I think not unless we go through a big cost restructuring. So the cost restructuring piece, yes, the actual teaching point, good. I should follow up. It was here, yeah.
Hi, I'm a student at Chicago Kent, and I am in one of those transitional programs that you talked about, which is a year of intellectual property management and markets, where instead of a 3-year law degree, I'm going to come away with a year of law, business, and computer science and kind of be a connector. So you're affirming a lot of my choices today. Thank you.
Shout out your law school as being one of the leaders in all of this. So yeah.
Yes, it's one of two programs in the country, which is a lot of why I went there. But I volunteered Access to Justice and Access to Practices, which is the thing at the Cook County Courthouse, where people off the streets can use these kind of automation systems. And people are always afraid, oh, it's going to take the law jobs. But all the students who are trained there say, We must tell them we are not lawyers. We must tell them that we cannot give them legal advice. And so that was just one thing I thought about, like the bulletproof vest. It's like, well, we're not actually becoming lawyers at the end of that. Once we finish our law degree, we will. Which brings me to placement, which was what you talked about. You've given me a lot of great ideas as far as being proactive on going to conferences and sort of setting up my website. And not even because at the end of the year of IPMM, we'll be trained to think like business people and like lawyers, but I will still go back to law school. You know, I will become employable right away and I can go to law school at night, but that's my choice and that's what they're kind of coming away with. You know, being a competitive person, they're going to, I kind of want to know what you think about how you sell yourself as a student, because people are going to be like, is she a lawyer? Is she this? What does she fit for our company? Do you have any suggestions?
Good question.
I think you say I'm both. You know, I'm a multi-threat. You know, I'm one of the coolest people going because I'm both. You know, and I can solve problems that you know. One trick, by the way, with this, before you talk to an employer, is find out everything you can about what their business actually does. Never go to an interview cold. Always go to an interview having researched the company, researched the people you're going to be talking with, know what problems they solve. Ask them questions about how do you solve this problem when you've got, they go, oh yeah, that is a problem. And then you've got a discussion going and they say, well, you know, I'm just starting out of this, but I had an idea that maybe, yeah, and did you try that? And oh yeah, we did try that, but we had a trouble. And suddenly, you see what I'm saying? So, or even ask them how they blend the two. You know, ask them, and then you've got an answer. So in terms of placement, I would urge you to go to the ABA show if you haven't gone yet. It's right in Chicago. Go there, wander around. The folks at Cali, when I was out for that conference, were bragging on the fact. They said, "Yeah, good enough. You only got them a couple jobs. We've got three or four." You know, so anyway, yeah, they can do that. They can do that. I had here, and then over here, and then here. Yeah.
Looking at your model, I'm sort of wondering how you envision the third year of law school functioning, since there's been more and more discussion about whether it should be a practice-based model, really a barfoot model, whether it should exist at all. I mean, especially if we're talking about your two or three objectives, and one of those being economic sustainability, perhaps removing a three-year all-free in some way might be more cost-efficient. So I was wondering how, if we want to really prepare
what a great question. And actually, again, at Vermont Law School, we just offered a 3-for-2 accelerated law degree, in which if you go for 6 straight semesters, we'll graduate you and we'll charge you for 2 years. There we go. Those of you listening in the audience, Vermont Law School. There we are. And I think you may find more of that. What is interesting then is if you want to tag on for the same price, you can do a specialist master's at the end of that for as a third year. And now you know you've spent what you would have spent, but you've gotten a JD and a specialist master's out of it. So you may see solutions like that coming into the picture. You're right. The third year of experiential, wildly interesting, useful in some ways, puts even more pressure on the first 2 years. You know, you end up being, one of the problems with that is you end up being able to take almost, at least in the current structure, almost no electives, which is another reason to cut the current by 50% and then figure out where you go. Yeah, and then over here. Yeah.
You mentioned, JMs and sort of legal assistance, that sort of thing. Do you see, maybe as the end of that process, a return to the sort of pre-Lindelian days of more apprenticeships and things like that? Or I guess sort of how does tech play into that old model, and do you see any kind of, you know, reemergence of that sort of thing?
Good question, because I think we're talking about a middle term where the kind of thing I was talking about takes place. I think we're talking about a long term in which education looks very different. Whether it's apprenticeship and buying courses, you know, off an a la carte menu, you know, via a combination of distance and bricks and mortars, whether you know, a degree becomes something that is a certification by a testing service at the end of a bunch of things, you know, rather than a bricks and mortar style basis. I mean, there's a whole set of things which are likely to reshape. I'm not as good at predicting the future far out as I'd like to be, but I do think that there is no reason why the current education, sorry, let's go back. The current education is essentially a 19th century artifact based on industrialization. You bring people together to a central location at a set time, using mass transit and clocks and all that stuff, and you deliver content to them in that context. That is 19th century mill work. Okay? Worked okay? All that rest of it, but that's what it is. 21st century scattered work What is the legal, what is the educational equivalent of that? We're just beginning to see emerging, but it is likely to look something very different over time. Yes, sorry.
You mentioned access to justice,
yes,
and social justice several times during your talk, and that's my concern. So I'm trying to understand how these seismic shifts you're describing that we pretty much have to get in line with or in rhythm with, otherwise they will master us rather than we mastering them. How is this going to bring about a situation in which there is better access to the law? I mean, my experience with poor people and powerless people is that they're afraid of the law. They don't like to go to court, et cetera. How do we...
Well, we've seen this a bit in Vermont. Vermont has one of our collaborators in Vermont, Brock Rutter. Brock Rutter, who was also for a while a researcher here at Berkman, was commissioned by the Vermont family courts to automate all of the family law circumstances, basically. Now, in Vermont, as with many states in the country, in fact, Vermont's a little better than some, the vast majority of family law procedures are pro se, because people can't afford lawyers. Now, you know, in some ways that's a bit of a scandal. It's certainly an opaque barrier between people's real needs for settling the disputes of families and the processes we put in place. Shame on us as a society for creating that. What the Vermont family courts have done is essentially created through the Chicago Kent Cali Access to Justice interview and logic engine, the A to J engine, have created a whole series of back of interviews, of expert system-based interviews, for filling in the core documents that need to be filed in order to get a divorce, you know, have a child custody dispute, you know, all of the most standard things that people need. So instead of coming in and being handed a set of forms and said, fill it out, technology has been able to create these question and answer systems which lead people through and with some background information and all this. Now, there is still the digital divide problem that some people just don't know enough about digital to actually be able to do even that. But they, as you mentioned, in the Cook County courthouses, they've got kiosks of these in the family courts. You can go home and do it, or you can do it out of the library. The libraries have information on how to get to this stuff. So people are then led through a Q&A, the end point of which is a fileable document that the court will take. And is this as good as having a lawyer? And the answer is no. Is it better than not? The answer is than not having it. The answer, I think, is yes. And what's really interesting is lawyers in Vermont are starting to use it to charge much less to a client to do the same thing. So that if you want a lawyer's help on your divorce, you go in and you go through this with the lawyer for $500, and you've got something that's actually got some lawyer content as well. So it's not an either or. There's a middle ground. Criminal law, we have not seen this in criminal law, partly because I think the pressure is a little less. You know, you've got, what is it, Gideon Wainwright, which says basically, you know, if you're a criminal, you're charged at least at the felony level, you get a lawyer. And so you know, the lawyer may be hard. Legal aid is using these systems, however, to increase their productivity within legal aid. So you're seeing pieces of this coming into legal aid in that kind of context. Again, I would refer you to the work of Ron Stout. He has a good chapter in the Educating the Digital Lawyers book on this, which I think is a very good exploration. Cali has a whole program exploring how to put this to use. There are folks, you know, clever folks working on this that are doing good work. Here, and then we will go. Okay.
I guess I'm taking up a theme that a lot of people have brought up, but my question is, in trying to figure out where we can trim the fat on the existing legal curriculum, the problem as I see it is that there, as long as the cost of the legal education is set at a certain amount, it's going to predispose people to search jobs that are going to help them offset what they put into it. And yet the problem with access to justice, like this person mentioned, is that there's a long tail out there of people of legal needs that don't exist, or that won't be met by graduating law school and then getting hired by a big company. And as long as that's the model, it seems as if we're not going to serve those people. And the question I guess I have is, we're talking about these changes, some more radical than others, but if we're going to do creative destruction, I think there ought to be, or there might be an idea of a two-tiered system where there is the trade school. There's nothing wrong with the trade school. It teaches you how to be a lawyer in a community, how to do the kinds of things that people actually need to be done. And I'm wondering, I guess, what the resistance to that might be and how you get around it, to the point where you look at law school as a place to get a job, to do something that's not going to necessarily pay you a huge amount of money, but it'll pay you a decent living wage to do decent work.
Well, one of the things is that actually Vermont Law School is to some degree what you've just described, partly because we do have the environmental and social justice activism. A lot of our folks go into government, a lot of our folks go into nonprofits, a lot of our folks go into that kind of thing. One of the things that's interesting is that that while the cost is steep, the increase in what you'll get as a salaried person as a lawyer in one of those is actually will more than pay for the cost of your legal education. So that in terms of an actual investment, although the whole scale is lower, the actual increase into that context is still a decent investment. That said, it still probably needs to come back. And one of the things that's tough in all this is while we're talking about all this, we need to figure out ways to make it cheaper. Whether it's one of the reasons actually Vermont has moved to this AJD is saying, you know, look, folks, you know, we're gonna make a system work in which it's just less of a ticket because a lot of our folks need to have that opportunity. How to make that sustainable is another question. We'll figure that out as we go forward. Another piece of it is I challenge your notion of where legal education is going. This whole notion that we're into the big firm thing and, you know, all that stuff, that's actually a very narrow slice. That's a very narrow slice of a very narrow set of very privileged law schools. Am I a graduate of one of those? I am. I went to Wall Street right off the bat. You know, there we are. But that said, that isn't where most of legal education is in fact happening. And it is what you described is what most people going to legal education in the United States of America are actually already experiencing. And if some of the elite schools get that nibbled into them a little bit, I'm not going to cry. Because we need to have good lawyers from wherever they went to school across a wide variety of practices in the United States. And if you really view that the law school, law is a career which will hand you the partnership at the big firm that will give you a seven-figure income, then may you enjoy it. Because I did that for a while, and I hated it. It's an appalling way to live. There are people who do enjoy it. May they enjoy it. But you do not have to do that to make this a good investment. It's a great investment in time, money, prestige, getting to do stuff you want to do. It's a good investment across all of those, and I don't regret it for a moment. Here and then up there, yeah.
Yeah, thanks. I'm from Germany, so we have a different law system there, and I'm wondering if you ever thought about how that, or if you know more resources, how this discussion is also in Roman law systems, so where you don't. Where it's more about codification and following the code. So for instance, we study law for 7 years, not for 2 or 3 years. So how can we apply these thoughts you have, these ideas, in a different environment?
Ah, good question. There is nothing in the law and technology that is inherent to the common law system.
Yeah.
In fact, actually, Germany was a center of some of the earliest thinking, not entirely successful, but earliest thinking about legal automation. They tried to jump to automating judicial practices, which is the wrong place. That was the hard problem, and it's also a place that's actually the cheapest locus of activity in legal services. So what they did there, I think, is not the model you want to think about. The University of Pavia in Italy, I'm aware of, has a center. I'm actually part of one of their research programs. Has a center for law science and technology. They are in fact actively pursuing some of this stuff. Talking into some of the more progressive schools around. So if you're interested, you might go to their website. Was it folks from Tübingen? I'm forgetting. There's some folks from maybe Tübingen who are doing some of this in Germany. I think they're 3 or 4 years behind us, but only that. I think that 6 or 7 years from now, you will find that the Europe is right in the midst of all of this. Yes.
Changes, there might be a further segmentation or balkanization of tiers of law schools or the ways that law schools get grouped together, and that might actually exacerbate some bad things. Like I'm thinking, okay, national law schools, extremely prestigious, regional law schools, local law schools, more technical, etc. And that obviously can be good and bad, but I'm just wondering if you anticipate that these changes would potentially further segment this in some ways, or would totally shift the way that we categorize or think about.
Possibly, although I also think that again we're going to see to some degree, a breakdown of the prestige piece that has been driving a lot of this. What's interesting to see is, again, my home institution in Vermont is not, other than outside of the environmental area, is not seen necessarily as a high-prestige school. A number of our graduates have gotten deeply involved in some of these things and are having fabulous careers. I think, actually, there's a chance for democratization, a redemocratization of law schools if they grab on and become leaders in this. The folks from Suffolk who are here, I think, may be feeling the exact same thing. It's breaking open. It's breaking open. You know, folks who get taught this stuff can come from almost anywhere if they're good and they're able to do it. You know, so in some ways, the future that you're predicting could be the future that I'm at least holding up as an alternative could be. I think that we'll be interested to see where it goes. Is this school gonna go away? No. But this school is going to need to figure out how to fit into this as well. And to their credit, this institution of Berkman is in some ways exactly that piece for Harvard. But it's not. Who are the leaders in this? You know, well, Suffolk is out there. Michigan State. You know, Indiana,
Chicago, Kent.
You know, you got folks who are. I think you're going to see the deck at least get reshuffled. Time for last question. Last question, yeah.
You've talked about law school curriculums. What about professional practice in terms of ongoing professional development across the, you know, graduating is one thing, but 30 years out, things are changing. I'm working with people who are literally in the process of rewriting the job descriptions of lawyers and chief financial accountants and all those kinds of people. What are your thoughts in terms of communities of practice or ongoing education and professional development?
Excellent question. I mean, there is already the CLE, but the CLE is some are tackling some of this. One of the interesting things that we're also thinking about is how do you modularize some of this education in a way that then can be redeployed into folks with knowledge. We'd be happy to chat a little bit because we've got some ideas on that to turn the dreaded CLE into an actually, you know, useful a piece of this. Part of what's necessary to do this well is you need alliances with providers. What we find is that you need alliances with tech providers who will actually make things available to you. And that's one of the things we're working on is developing that net of alliances. And so it may well be that some of that is how it works. Anyway, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I can stick around for a few minutes. I'd be happy to chat a little more with folks offline if you're interested. I appreciate your thoughts and comments, and I appreciate your listening to me. Thank you very much.